wasn't putting dollars in his pocket. It seemed he'd never get out of his rut. In frustration, he left his kids with his mother and went back to Van Buren one last time. He thought maybe he could get some cheap land and resume farming, something he had never gotten out of his blood. He had no trouble finding work on a potato farm, but as always, he couldn't make enough money. And Maurice was lonely. He missed his kids. He missed his mother. And he missed Christine. Just when life seemed to be at its lowest point, Maurice met Erica. She was working in the potato fields with him. Petite and slim, with red hair and green eyes, Erica seemed the answer to his dreams. He needed a wife, and his children needed a mother. He quickly asked her to marry him. Erica, who was raising a small boy on her own, was equally lonely and agreed to assume both roles. They married and moved back to Massachusetts, to a farm in Belchertown, a little village a few miles east of Holyoke, where they began growing fruits and vegetables. But their marriage proved to be little more than one of convenience. There was no passion in it, and the 9-year union produced no children. It turned out that Erica and Maurice had almost nothing in common, and they lived from day to day in their own separate worlds. During the years he was with Erica, Maurice found himself turning inward more than ever before. He couldn't share his feelings with Erica, and felt more and more isolated in the marriage. Strange things would happen to him, but he never told her about any of them. He never told anybody, preferring to keep it all to himself. For instance, in the fall of 1965, he was once out walking through his tomato patch, when he almost tripped over a wooden cross. "Where the hell did that come from?" he muttered to himself. When he reached down to pick it up, Maurice's eyes began to get blurry. He started to rub them, but stopped when he felt a gushy liquid on his fingers. When he pulled his hands away, he noticed his fingers were covered with blood. He hadn't remembered cutting himself, but he ran into the house and headed straight for the bathroom to check himself in the mirror. He could hardly believe what he was seeing. Blood was seeping from both eyes. Maurice tried to clean the blood up with a tissue, but he couldn't get it to stop. The funny thing was that he couldn't find a cut or a scrape around either of his eyes. He thought maybe he should get himself to a doctor, but for some reason, he stayed right there. He continued to stand in front of the mirror and watch as the blood poured from his eyes, down his face, onto his shirt, and into the sink. Maurice was transfixed as he watched his eyes bleed. He felt no pain or fear. It was almost as if he had gone into a trance. He was in the bathroom for about 20 minutes when Erica began banging on the door. "Maurice, you all right? What's the matter?" Startled, Maurice emerged from his trance-like state. He looked at himself and noticed some dried blood on his face and shirt. He quickly cleaned himself up. "I'll be right out," he said, taking off his shirt and throwing it into the hamper. "I just cut myself shaving. It's nothing." Erica was glad that Maurice wasn't sick. They were going to a dance at the Elks Hall that night, and she didn't want him to back out again. He did that all too often. When Maurice came out, he seemed unusually quiet, as if he was deep in thought. Erica wanted to ask if something was bothering him, but she decided not to. He'd been a little touchy lately, she thought. Better not to start an argument. They left for the dance about 8 that night, but Maurice had barely said a word since he'd come out of the bathroom. Inside the dance hall, he sat down at a corner table, not bothering to say hello to anybody, not even to some of his pals from the factory. And he never even asked Erica to dance. She didn't know what to make of his strange behavior. Maurice wasn't what she would have called outgoing, but he usually enjoyed these dances. He liked country music, and even though he wasn't much of a dancer, after a couple of drinks he would be up stomping his feet, especially if the band was playing one of his favorite songs, such as the Orange Blossom Special. Invariably, Maurice and Erica would stay at the Elks Hall until last call at 1 a.m., and then head over to a friend's house for one or two more before calling it a night. But tonight, Maurice would have none of that. It wasn't much past 10 when he announced to Erica that he wanted to leave, that he had something important to do. Naturally, Erica was upset. She had been waiting all week for this evening, and now Maurice was going to spoil it. She started to argue, but Maurice seemed in no mood for a fight. He simply said he was leaving and that she'd better come along, because he wasn't going to wait for her. Erica swallowed hard and gave in. She could tell Maurice wasn't in the mood to be persuaded to stay. As was usually the case when they disagreed, Erica gave Maurice the silent treatment. She got into the Chrysler New Yorker without saying a word, slamming the door behind her. Most times Maurice would try to smooth things over, making a joke or promising to do something to make it up to her, such as take her out to lunch at Freddy's Diner or to the Dairy Queen for a sundae. But tonight, he seemed to be giving her his own version of the silent treatment, except that he didn't seem at all angry or upset with her. He just wasn't talking. He drove quietly, staring ahead as they drove down Route 202. There was a fork in the road about 2 miles from home, and it required slowing down to take the left turn. Directly in the middle of the fork was a sturdy old oak tree. As Maurice approached the fork, Erica noticed that he wasn't slowing down. She wanted to say something, but was still giving him the silent treatment and didn't want to break it. Yet Maurice continued to drive straight for the tree, and he showed no signs of turning or stopping.
"Frenchie!" she shouted.
But Maurice didn't even hear her. He continued to head for the tree. He seemed to be transfixed, in some sort of a trance. It was as if he was determined to crash. Seconds before the car went off the road and straight for the tree, Erica reached over and grabbed the wheel, turning it quickly toward her. The quick action probably saved their lives. Instead of hitting the tree head-on, the car careened sideways into a stone wall that ran along the side of the road. The crash was loud, as metal crunched and glass shattered. But when it was over, neither Maurice nor Erica had received even a scratch. Erica was practically hysterical.
"Maurice, what were you trying to do? Kill us both? Are you insane?"
Maurice turned toward Erica and pulled her toward him.
"What happened?" he asked.
Maurice didn't even remember having left the dance. He had no recollection of driving home. All he knew was that the crash had startled him out of what seemed to be a deep sleep. Erica didn't want to hear it. She figured her husband was losing his mind. There were other things, but she had tried to dismiss them. There was the time their pet beagle, Peter, was killed, for instance. Maurice told her he had been hit by a car, but later she found a bloody pick in the area where he'd said the accident had occurred. It was Maurice's pick. But it didn't make any sense that he would kill Peter. Maurice loved that dog and took him out hunting nearly every Sunday during the season. And the day after the dog had been killed, Maurice had buried him in the woods, crying all the while as he dug the grave. Then there was the time she had watched out the kitchen window as Maurice beat his riding horse, a pinto named Bar Coda, with a stick after the horse had failed to learn a trick Maurice was trying to teach him. When Erica chastised Maurice about being too rough with the animal, Maurice professed not to know what she was talking about.
"I would never hit Bar Coda," he said. "I love that horse."
Erica believed him. She knew that he did love that animal. But she also knew what she had seen. But Maurice would not accept responsibility for his bizarre behavior. He blamed Erica, claiming that she put him up to the violent acts. It made no sense, but there were simply times when Maurice made no sense. Not to Erica, not to anybody. It was as if there was another person inside him. When that other person took over his personality, anything was possible. Maurice's strange behavior was taking its toll on the marriage. Twice Erica left him and went back to Maine. Both times Maurice went up and brought her back. Eventually, though, she left him for good.
"You're crazy," she said as she walked out the door. "You ought to see a head shrinker."
This time Maurice didn't even try to get her back. He knew he was wrong, that he had caused Erica to leave, and that she had good reason for leaving. He decided he'd just have to carry on alone. He had been through this before. He'd manage without her. But he wondered if she was right. Maybe he was going crazy. But farmers didn't see psychiatrists. Whatever was bothering him, Maurice thought, he'd figure it out. Maybe that mysterious force that he'd called on for help in the fields would come to his aid again. Alone again, Maurice decided he needed a plan of action. And as had been the case so many times before, Maurice's plan involved a change of scenery. This time, he decided to leave Massachusetts for upstate New York. He'd stay with his uncle, Kevin Ferrand, in the town of Greenfield, outside Saratoga Springs, site of the famous health spa. He had always liked Uncle Kevin, and knew the old man could probably use some help cutting wood for the winter. When he got there, Uncle Kevin was happy to have him, but there wasn't much work to be had on his tiny farm. Maurice had to look around for additional work, and found it on Simon Juno's farm. He helped in the fields and cut wood, too. Simon let him sell some of what he cut to make some extra money. It was a good arrangement for Maurice, and Simon didn't mind. He liked Maurice and wanted him to stick around. The two men had become drinking buddies and liked to stay up late at night, sitting around the pot-bellied stove in the kitchen, drinking whiskey and beer and swapping stories. One chilly night in November of 1979, Maurice showed up, as usual, with a bottle of Jim Beam bourbon for himself and a six-pack of Genesee beer for Simon. But before they could get down to some serious drinking, the old man asked Maurice for a favor.
"Frenchie, can you help me out? Give my daughter a ride to work, okay? Her car is busted."
Simon's daughter, Nancy, was working the night shift at General Foods. She would go in at 11 and work until 7 in the morning. It wasn't ideal, but as a divorced mother of three girls, Nancy couldn't be choosy. Maurice had seen Nancy many times around the farm, but he had never gotten to know her. Usually she was sleeping when he was working in the fields, or heading out the door to her job when he came over at night to drink with Simon. Nancy was an attractive woman of 40, with curly red-brown hair and hazel eyes. She had a deep, sexy voice, and was very articulate and outspoken. She had been married to a policeman for 13 years before her divorce 3 years earlier, and was used to hanging around with cops, not farmers. Maurice couldn't help being captivated by Nancy from the first time he saw her, but he never made a move for her. For one thing, he didn't know how Simon would feel about it. Second, he was a little intimidated by her. He was still basically shy when it came to women, and he noticed that she wasn't afraid to voice her opinions, probably from hanging around cops for so many years. He figured he wasn't her type. But he was glad to give Nancy a ride to work. They didn't say much on the way to the plant where she worked as a packer, but Maurice enjoyed the few minutes they spent alone together. She seemed genuinely interested in him, and it turned out that she didn't look down on him at all because he was just a farmer. After all, she was a country girl. Maurice decided to make a pass at her. He was 43 years old, and he'd been lonely in the year since he and Erica had been divorced. But it was more than that. There was something about Nancy. She moved him as he had never been moved before. She was strong and smart and wouldn't take any guff from anybody. She would make a good partner. The next night, Maurice came over earlier than usual and offered right away to drive Nancy to work. When they got into his pickup, he breathed deeply and announced,
"You can move over closer if you want."
Nancy tried to stifle a laugh.
"That's okay, Frenchie. I'm fine right here."
and she remained leaning against the door, not budging an inch. But inside, she was glad he had asked. She was wondering if he would ever make a pass at her. Now that he had tried, she wanted to take it slowly. She had been burned before. No reason to rush into anything. There was plenty of time. Maurice gave Nancy a ride to work for the rest of the week. He wanted to make another move the entire time, but he was afraid he'd be rejected again. She hadn't exactly jumped at the offer to sit beside him that second night. But he decided that if he didn't do something by Friday, he might not get another chance. She was due to get her car back from the shop on Saturday. On his way back home Thursday night, he devised a plan. The next day, he'd load up the front seat of his pickup with tools, lodging them up against the passenger side door. And when it came time to give Nancy a ride to work that night, he'd tell her the passenger side door was jammed, and she'd have to get in through the driver's side. If she did, she'd have to sit in the center of the seat, right next to him. The plan worked to perfection. Nancy got in without hesitation, and she sat right by his side. Of course, she knew that it was all a ruse, but she didn't mind. She had been waiting patiently for him to make another move, and she thought his trick was pretty clever. By the time they got to the factory, Nancy was hugging Maurice. As he dropped her at the gate, Maurice asked if he could pick her up in the morning and take her to breakfast. Usually, Nancy got a ride home with one of her girlfriends. She was thrilled that he'd asked and told him so. When her shift was over at 7 in the morning, Maurice was waiting by the gate, and he was wearing his best Western suit. It was gray with black lapels. He wore a white shirt with silver tips on the collar and a string tie. "Frenchy, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship," she said, quoting a line from her favorite movie, Casablanca. From then on, they were inseparable. Soon afterward, they moved back to Massachusetts with the intention of buying themselves a small farm. This time, Maurice was certain that things were going to work out. Maurice and Nancy moved to the town of East Longmeadow, a small farming community just south of Springfield. For the first time in a long time, things were really going well for Maurice. His relationship with Nancy couldn't have been any better. Their little rented farm was prospering, so much so that they were thinking of buying some property of their own. They were again living close to Maurice's mother, and he was glad of that. He always missed his mother when he wasn't living nearby. Now he was only about 15 miles away. It wasn't quite the same as when they were in the same town, but they were still near enough for frequent visits. Maurice and his father were even beginning to talk to each other. They weren't exactly close. That would have been impossible, considering the way Philip had treated Maurice as a child. But at least they no longer openly hated each other. When Maurice would drop by to visit his mother, Philip would sometimes come over and make small talk. Usually he'd ask Maurice how his tomato plants were faring. Once in a while, he'd even ask about his grandchildren. Maybe it was because so many of his other kids had moved far away, to Oklahoma City. First, it was Philip Jr., known as Phil. He was 5 years younger than Maurice, and always seemed to have been Philip's favorite, if there was such a thing. However, even Phil eventually fell out of favor with Philip. It happened when Phil's car, which Philip had signed for, was repossessed. Philip exploded at Phil with a fury that he usually reserved for Maurice. Phil moved to Oklahoma not long afterward. After Phil left, several more of the family followed him out there. First Lucy, then Betty, then Julie, and then Jason. The thinning out of his flock seemed to make Philip more reflective. He still had his moods, though. It was just that he would no longer explode the way he used to when Maurice was a child. These days, Philip seemed to keep his hostility inside. Maurice could sometimes see the anger building up in him. He had good built-in radar for that. But instead of lashing out at the nearest person, Philip would just stomp out of the room, slamming the door behind him. Although he was glad that his father seemed to be making an effort to make amends, Maurice was troubled by Philip's new pattern of behavior. At least in the old days, he knew what to expect. Now, he compared his father to a ticking time bomb. Maurice feared that if his father didn't let his anger out, he might one day go off the deep end and do something really hideous. But Maurice tried not to dwell on those fears. After all, he was just a tomato farmer, not a psychiatrist, and he had his own problems to deal with. While the strange events that had ruined his marriage to Erica had, for the most part, subsided, there was still an occasional incident that caused him to worry. There was the time he and Nancy had gone to look at a farm in Warren, Massachusetts, about 25 miles northeast of Longmeadow. They were standing on the porch, discussing the pros and cons of buying the property. In the middle of their talk, Nancy took out the cross that she always wore around her neck, a cross given to her by her mother. "Let's ask Jesus to help us decide, Maurice," she said. All of a sudden, Maurice's eyes widened and looked as if they were on fire. He stared at Nancy as if she had done something terrible. Then he reached over and, using both hands, pushed her off the porch. Before Nancy could say anything, Maurice had leapt off the porch and was on top of her. He yanked the cross, chain and all, from around her neck and threw it into the woods. Nancy was crying.
"Maurice, what did you do that for? That cross was a gift from my mother. What's gotten into you?"
But Maurice was already back on the porch and was mumbling,
"I have her by the hand. I have her by the hand."
Nancy came over to him, but he seemed to have forgotten the incident. Nancy tried to get him to talk about what he had done with the cross, but Maurice insisted he didn't know what she was talking about. The next night, however, Maurice told Nancy he had something for her, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out the cross.
"Maurice, you went back to get it for me," Nancy said, astonished. "I'm so glad. But how did you find it? Those woods are thick with brush."
"I didn't find it," Maurice said. "A lady found this cross. A lady in white. She took me by the hand and led me to where this cross was. I don't even remember where, but she showed me right where it was."
"What lady? Who?" Nancy asked.
Maurice hesitated. Then he blurted out something that frightened Nancy. "I didn't get a good look at her face, but I think it was your mother." Nancy sat down.
"I think I need a drink of water," she said.
She didn't know what to think of Maurice's story. Her mother had been dead for 15 years. Maybe, she thought, her husband had seen her spirit. It was her mother's cross and chain. Maybe her mother had come back to help him retrieve it. Nancy figured anything was possible. She had a spiritual nature and a lot of faith. Maybe spirits do exist, she thought. After all, the Holy Ghost is a spirit, right? She had never seen a ghost, that was true, and neither had Maurice, as far as she knew. But there was always a first time for everything. On the other hand, it was also possible that Maurice was crazy. She decided to try the spirit theory. It gave her hope that she might see her mother again, which felt very comforting.
"Yes, Maurice," she said. "It was probably my mother's spirit."
She said it, but unconvincingly. She just didn't know what to believe. Despite the strange incident, Maurice and Nancy decided to go ahead and buy the farmhouse in Warren. Not long afterward, Philip announced, out of nowhere, that he was moving his family to Oklahoma, to be closer to Philip Jr., and the other children who had moved there over the past few years. Maurice was upset. He didn't want to be so far from his mother. But something else bothered him even more. He didn't know why, but he had a sinking feeling that he would never see Alice again. He begged his father not to pull up and move west, but it was no use. Once his mind was made up about something, there was no changing it, and Maurice knew that. After they had gone, Maurice's mother was constantly on his mind. A feeling of doom came over him whenever he thought about her living out there in the middle of nowhere. His father's hasty decision to move to Choctaw, Oklahoma, just didn't sit right with him. Just what had been going through Philip's mind? A year went by. Maurice called his mother long distance from time to time, and things seemed to be going okay. Maurice's fear that his father might revert to his old violent ways hadn't come true. Instead, he was only getting more sullen and depressed, Alice reported. Sometimes, she said, it was more frightening than when he used to throw a chair or lash out with a belt. So the nagging worry continued to weigh heavily on Maurice's mind. One night in June 1982, Maurice and Nancy were getting ready to go to bed when they heard a strange noise in the house. It sounded like somebody mumbling downstairs.
"Maurice, did you hear that?" she asked.
"It sounds like somebody talking, but I can't make it out," he said. "I'll go down and take a look around."
Maurice came back up a few minutes later.
"Nobody down there," he reported. "We must have imagined it."
They got into bed and heard the sounds again.
"Maurice, there's definitely somebody down there. In fact, I hear two voices, a man and a woman. It's like they're arguing. Shh, listen."
Maurice had heard it too. He got out of bed and ran down the stairs again. But when he got to the living room, the noises had stopped. He looked around everywhere, but found nobody. They were both a little frightened, but figured it had to be their imaginations. Sometimes the wind can play tricks. He climbed back into bed and told Nancy there was nothing to worry about. Before he drifted off to sleep, he had worried thoughts about his mother. For some reason, he thought she was in some kind of danger. He thought of calling her, but it was late. He'd call her in the morning. Maurice and Nancy were awakened before dawn by a loud pounding on the front door.
"Open up! Open up!"
Maurice kicked off the sheets and grabbed a robe before heading down the stairs. He opened the door and saw a somber-faced police officer standing there.
"We tried to call you, but nobody answered,"
the policeman said. A cold chill ran down Maurice's spine.
"What's the matter?" he demanded.
By this time, Nancy had rushed downstairs and stood by Maurice's side.
"What's going on?"
"You better call your sister Lucy in Oklahoma," the cop replied. "There's been a terrible accident. I'm sorry."
Then he turned and walked to his cruiser. Maurice's heart sank. The sense of doom was so real that he could almost taste it. Something horrible had happened. The cop hadn't said so, but he knew somehow that his mother had been involved. He held his breath while he dialed Lucy's number in Choctaw. Before the end of the first ring, however, Maurice's palms got sweaty and his head began spinning. Everything turned white. He dropped the phone and fell to the floor. As Nancy grabbed the phone, Maurice's brother-in-law, Ken Paxton, answered at the other end.
"Ken, this is Nancy," she shouted. "What happened out there?"
"Nancy," he said, his voice almost a whisper, "you better sit down."
6. In June 1982, the following article appeared in the Holyoke Tribune transcript. Police in Oklahoma expect a final report Wednesday on the apparent murder-suicide of a former Holyoke couple living in Choctaw, Oklahoma. Choctaw Police Chief Randy Holt today said only technical reports from the medical examiner's office, ballistics office, and the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation need to be finished. "We expect the final report to go along the lines of the preliminary ruling from the medical examiner's office and our investigation, which ruled it a murder-suicide," Holt said. Philip, 69, and Alice, Pelletier Ferriol, 64, of Choctaw, were found dead in their bedroom Friday morning. Police said the cause of death was gunshot wounds. The Ferriol's daughter, Lucy Waldrop, of Nakoma Park, Oklahoma, with whom the couple was staying, found the bodies after hearing shots. Police said three shots were fired by Mr. Ferriol. They said the first shot missed and lodged in the headboard of the bed, while the second struck Mrs. Ferriol in the right side of the head. Mr. Ferriol then shot himself in the chest, according to police. Funeral services for the couple will be Wednesday morning at the Messier Ferriol Funeral Home, Chestnut Street, Holyoke, followed by the Liturgy of Christian Burial in Our Lady of Perpetual Help Church here. Burial will be in Notre Dame Cemetery, South Hadley. Calling hours at the funeral home are Tuesday from 2 to 9 p.m. Maurice had scarcely gotten up from his chair since he came to after the phone call to Oklahoma. Suddenly, life seemed to have lost all meaning. His beloved maman was gone. Nancy had come over to him several times, trying to comfort and console him, but it was no use. He didn't want to talk. He didn't want to eat. He didn't want to do anything. All he could do was think about what had happened out there in Oklahoma. He had worried for years that Philip might snap and do something like this. Maybe I could have prevented it. Why didn't I call last night? He thought. He tortured himself by imagining his mother's last few violent moments of life. He played the scene in his mind over and over again. There must have been a struggle. He probably had been beating her. She was shot at a close distance. Oh, poor Maman. My beloved, poor, sweet Maman. Finally, after darkness had fallen, Maurice, his mind exhausted, fell off to sleep, still in the same easy chair he had been sitting in all day. And he began to dream. In Maurice's dream, Alice Theriault woke slowly in the early morning light in Nakoma Park, Oklahoma. Even though she knew she was awake, she kept her eyes shut. She could hear her husband, Philip, moving around the bedroom of their daughter's house, and she had no desire to see him right away. It would automatically turn into a confrontation. She didn't want to spoil this visit with Lucy. It had been such a long time since they had been together. And if Philip started cursing or hitting her, a family scene was sure to follow, as was usually the case. She smiled a little to herself, to think that she'd always had the notion that her golden years would be easier. After more than 40 years of marriage to this volcanic personality, Alice still never knew where or when one of his maniacal outbursts might occur. There were days when he might not bother to wake her, preferring to have a solitary coffee in the kitchen, and other days when, if she didn't get up and prepare his breakfast, his face would turn purple with rage, and he would take off his thick leather belt and whip her out of bed. Having suffered almost half a century of abuse, Alice had stopped asking why Philip could be so angry about something one day and not notice it the next. She had stopped asking, as well, why it was her lot to suffer abuse from such a man. She was simply grateful for the few isolated moments like these, when she could lie in bed and drift, the light from the windows suffusing the inside of her eyelids with a warm glow that gave her thoughts a rosy hue. Lying under the heavy coverlet that protected her from the brisk weather that had lingered into June, Alice let herself enjoy her dreamy state. She pictured her parents, whose warm example of love and mutual respect had stayed with her, in bitter contrast to her own marriage. Maman and Papa had been so happy together when she was growing up in Van Buren, Maine. She had thought all marriages must be the same. With Philip Ferriol, she had found out just how different some unions could be. As an adolescent, Alice had worked as a seamstress. There had been such fun when she could work and giggle with the other girls in their homes, doing the piecework that often gave them cramps in their hands, and didn't pay enough to buy one of the dresses they were making. Still, she had loved the companionship, and she and her special girlfriends had often walked arm in arm to downtown Van Buren for a movie or soda. When Philip Ferriall had begun courting her, she was afraid of him. He was 5 years older than she was, and already had the rugged build and dark beard of a man. Alice still felt, in many ways, as if she had just become a teenager. But the other girls thought him strong and handsome, and her parents, loving as they were, did nothing to discourage a match that might mean she would marry and leave the house. After all, there were too many mouths to feed and too many daughters to marry off. So she had married and had regretted it, and continued to regret it every day of her life. Philip had quickly proved himself to be a bully of the worst kind. Alice realized within weeks that the hulking farmer had married her just to have a maid who would cook and clean and sleep with him. On Saturday nights, when she knew that her girlhood friends were at the movies, as she herself had been such a short time ago, she would have to sit quietly in the corner while Philip got viciously drunk. She had asked once if she couldn't go out with her old friends, but her husband had called her a tramp and forbidden it. In any case, she couldn't afford it, since Philip gave her no money. No, her best hope was to be quiet, and hope that Philip would drink until he passed out, before becoming physically abusive. He had hit her on their wedding night, and although the blows were rare, the threat of them had never abated. She had thought at first to leave him, but she had become pregnant almost immediately after the wedding. 7 sons and 8 daughters had followed, and any thought that she might escape her disastrous marriage had vanished in the avalanche of work involved in taking care of her children. Philip had never considered pregnancy a reason for her to stop her daily chores, and the number of children to be cared for made that an impossibility in any case. But she did love being a mother, despite the work, and found some fulfillment in having loving relationships with each of her children. Alice's thoughts turned to Maurice, her eldest. Although she had special feelings for each of her children, there was no denying that her relationship with Maurice was unique. He was a fine boy, a sweet boy, she thought, and she hoped that he might one day become a priest, one of God's chosen ministers. She had done her best throughout his childhood to protect him from Philip's murderous tantrums, to see that he was clean and well-fed, and that he got a good education. When Philip forced him to quit school, she had been as heartbroken as her son. She remembered tenderly the tranquil moments the two had shared when Philip wasn't there. Most of those moments seemed to have taken place in the kitchen when Maurice was still very young, surrounded by the smells of traditional French-Canadian dishes. Mother and son enjoyed what were perhaps the most loving moments in their lives for some 20 years. Alice remembered just as vividly the pain she had felt when Maurice had cursed his father in the field, and again when he'd left the house. She understood why he had to go, but it still removed one of the bright spots in her own existence, which was otherwise so hard and dreary. She also knew that, no matter how justified it was, no good could come of such a sacrilegious oath. Alice was convinced that now, with Nancy, the 43-year-old Maurice had found safe haven, had found the peace that had eluded him all his life. She thought of the mysterious stranger who had once picked Maurice out of a snowbank during a raging blizzard and delivered him safely home. "Guard him all his life, and bring him safely home to you," she silently prayed. Alice heard Philip leave and then quickly re-enter the room, opening and shutting drawers as if he was looking for something. She shut her eyes more firmly and feigned sleep. Lost in her few good memories, she had no desire to replace them immediately with the hard reality of Philip Ferriall and the state of Oklahoma. Alice did not like Oklahoma. The American West, with its windswept plains, rolling clouds, and harsh landscape,
seemed so alien after a lifetime in New England. Here there were no little villages with picturesque churches, no stone walls, no apple trees, no familiar faces. A woman of French-Canadian descent, who spoke English with a decided accent, when she spoke it at all, did not fit in a land of oil rigs and cowboys. Alice loved visiting her children, but lying there in the guest room of Lucy's house, she couldn't help but wish they were all back in Maine. Alice could not have known that she would never see the region of her birth again, would never see her children again, would never see another morning. Maurice's dream continued. In it, Alice was back in her parents' living room in Van Buren, trying to guess whether the delightful odor coming from the kitchen was her mother's pain complet, wheat bread, or a baguette, the long, thin loaf of French bread that accompanied all family dinners. It seemed to her that she could hear the voices of her brothers and sisters running and laughing about her. Large families were normal among the staunchly Catholic French-Canadian families of Maine, and hers was no different. Five brothers and four sisters made for a very lively household indeed. But even as these memories surrounded her, she was suddenly overcome by an overpowering stench, something acrid, putrid, as if all the animals in her father's barn had defecated there in her parents' living room. But as soon as this absurd thought presented itself, she realized it could not be, that the smell was here. Here in Nakoma Park, Oklahoma, here in the room with her. She opened her eyes. What she saw was so utterly terrifying, a scream throbbed in her throat. Philip was kneeling on the edge of the bed, leering down at her. He was dressed normally, wearing his habitual blue jeans and a plaid work shirt. But it was a Philip she had never seen, not even in his wildest rages. His brow was so swollen that it was ape-like, and his lips were drawn back over his teeth, giving his jaw the look of a muzzle. His eyes were black, like two bottomless holes. Alice knew she was in grave danger. She could not see Philip's hands, which seemed to be holding something under the folds of the coverlet, but she was sure he was holding his belt and was going to beat her. "Good morning," he purred. Alice gasped. The voice had come from Philip, but it was not his voice.
"Philip, why are you talking like that?" she asked.
"We are not Philip," he replied.
"We? What do you mean, we? Who are you? What are you?"
she whispered in French.
"Nous sommes des vieux copains de Philippe," the voice replied. "We are old buddies of Philip's."
The temperature of the room, which had been chilly but nothing more, now became freezing, and Alice shook under the covers, whether from fear or from the cold, she could not tell. Alice, who was both deeply religious and a bit superstitious, did not want to ask the next question, but searched instinctively to keep this creature talking.
"What is your name?"
But it didn't answer. Instead, a steady stream of talk, disjointed, bizarre, blasphemous, came forth.
"Mrs. Stickney, Mrs. Stickney, in cowl and beads and dusty garb. The eel is credited with the possession of many marvelous virtues. The power of transformation is shown in a multitude of cases. Fuck, fuck, fuck! Joan of Arc was married to the fire. Hideous. Wolf, cat, dog, griffin. Uriel, the nails. Sextus reigned 6 years. Ooh. Stick together now, mates. The claimant, the daring one, Mr. Homunculus. You ask me to tell you how we know the ruler of seven chains."
"What is your name?"
'Twas.
Who are you?
Not your mother.
And the creature with her husband's face began to cackle.
Astaroth, Baal, Cosby, Dagon, Azeroth, Baalim, Chamo, Belphegor, Astarte, Bethash, Fogor, Moloch, Asmodeus, Beel, Nergal, Melchon, Asima, Baal, Nexroth, Tartach, Acharom, Belial, Neabaz, Merodach, Adonides, Behemot, Jerubbaal, Sokothbanoth, Mahamer, Beelzebub, Leviathan, Lucifer, Satan.
Recognize us now?
Who are you?
We're the devil.
Alice fainted. Instantly, she felt herself being shaken so hard she thought her neck would snap.
Wake up, bitch!
The creature snarled. Opening her eyes again, Alice tried again to scream, but felt her cries cut off as a hand closed around her throat. Leaning close to her ear, the creature uttered a warning so absolute, in a voice that carried such pure menace, that Alice simply stared, terrified, at the ceiling.
Shut up, bitch, or we will kill you now,
it hissed. The animal-like face, barely recognizable as her husband's, was in front of her again, only inches from her eyes.
That's better, he said. Much better.
What are you going to do to me?
She quavered.
We are going to kill you. Then we are going to kill this disgusting worm that we have used for so many years,
he said, pointing at his own chest.
Don't you think that will be a fitting conclusion to all the years we've tortured you and your family? We've even tortured him.
He pointed again to himself.
If the truth be told, which it can be now, because you aren't going to be telling anybody.
He laughed, snorting in a repulsive way, snot dripping from his broad nostrils, foamy spittle collecting in the corners of his mouth. Blood began to seep from his eyes. Gazing at Alice, who lay paralyzed on the bed, he continued,
Yes, we've even tortured this worm, he said, his voice constantly changing, now a guttural snarl, now a crooning sing-song. So now his time is over. We're going to kill you, and then we're going to kill the worm. The police will come and rule it a murder-suicide. What else could it be? The police don't believe in us, which is very convenient indeed for us. After that, we will go and pay a visit to your dear son Maurice.
Alice closed her eyes.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, she whispered.
The creature looming over her giggled.
Chaire miram, kechari tumine,
he said in a strange language. He grabbed Alice by the shoulders, pulled her toward him, and slammed her into the bed over and over again.
Don't say that, bitch! Don't say that, bitch! Don't say that, bitch!
Finally, panting for breath, the creature who called himself Twas and said that he was the devil stopped his beating. But the covers on the bed were completely pulled loose, and now Alice could see her son-in-law's gun lying among the sheets. The gun was left over from Ken's days on the Louisiana police force, and last night, when he had come in, he had hung it on the fireplace. Now she stared at it, the way someone on the top floor of a tall building stares at the pavement below. Dizzy at the idea of what would happen if she fell, wondering in horror if she would feel anything. Through her terror, she sensed that her only hope was to continue talking to the creature, even though she felt she would endanger her soul by doing so.
Are you really the devil? She asked.
The devil, a devil. What do you care, you ugly old cunt? The main thing is, we're going to kill you, and then your husband, and then your son.
Why?
Why not? Weren't we invited in? Didn't this worm we are inhabiting like to curse everyone and everything? Didn't your son invoke our name?
His next words made Alice, for the first time, start to sob, for they came out of his mouth in the voice of Maurice.
I'd rather work for the devil than work for you, he mocked.
The tears ran down Alice's cheeks as she remembered Maurice's curse on his father.
Too bad he's not here, eh? Said the creature. He could work for us both at once.
And he let loose his demented laugh, strands of saliva hanging from his foul mouth. Grabbing the gun from the bed, he began to stroke it lovingly.
My lovely pet, my lovely pet, I want to fuck you, my lovely pet gun.
Alice thought for an instant of lunging for it, but her husband was far bigger and stronger than she, a condition that had forced her to passively accept his abuse all her life. She could not now, at this final moment, summon the courage to attack him in this horrible incarnation.
Maurice is almost awake, crowed the creature. We mustn't be late. The early bird gets the worm.
And he laughed hysterically again.
Twas must be going to visit your son.
Alice saw the death's head that now grinned down at her and began to pray.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Her prayer was cut off by the blast of gunfire and the thwack of a bullet crashing into the headboard beside her. As she started to rise and scream, the second shot caught her in the right temple. There was a bright burst, and the world went black before her eyes. As she rocketed down the long tunnel leading to death, the last thing she heard was the third gunshot and a voice gurgling.
The worm. The worm.
7. The devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. William Shakespeare, Hamlet. How are you fallen from heaven, Lucifer, son of the dawn? Cut down to the ground, and once you dominated the peoples. Didn't you say to yourself, I will be as high as heaven. I will be more exalted than the stars of God. I will, indeed, be the supreme leader. In the privileged places, I will be higher than the skies. I will be the same as the Most High God. But you shall be brought down to hell, to the bottom of its pit, and all who see you will despise you. Isaiah, chapter 14, verses 12 through 19. At the end of Stephen Vincent Benet's famous short story, The Devil and Daniel Webster, the Prince of Darkness is forced to promise that he will never again show his face in the state of New Hampshire. It is nowhere recorded that any such promise was made about Massachusetts. The Bay State's history is rife with documented cases of devil worship, witchcraft, and black magic. The state that is known for producing presidents and scholars is also known for Lizzie Borden, who took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, then when she was good and done, gave her father 41, and for being the home of Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. But there could hardly be a more unlikely spot for the dramatic events of 1985 than Warren, Massachusetts. On the western border of Worcester County, Warren is a rural town of 17,000 acres, 29.5 square miles, of scenic hills and valleys bisected by the Quaybog River. Located on Route 67, which connects with Routes 9 and 20, the The town has access to the Massachusetts Turnpike, 8 miles to the east and 10 miles to the west. It is equidistant from Worcester and Springfield, Massachusetts' second and third largest cities, respectively, each 25 miles away. The Quaybog River, which still bears traces of industrial dams of a century ago, recently has been favored by canoe and kayak enthusiasts. There is a pond and a swimming beach in Warren, and parks and playgrounds for the good weather months. Situated some 65 miles west of Boston, the town is buried in the southwestern angle of Worcester County, hidden far from the intense spotlight that shines on dear old Boston, home of the bean and the cod, where the Cabots speak only to the Lowells, and the Lowells speak only to God. This characterization of Boston by John Collins Bossidy, in his toast at the Holy Cross College alumni dinner in 1910, and known to all in the Boston area, certainly had nothing to do with Warren. Warren's prominence in the news was not to come from intellectuals like Bossidy, or from celebrated sports teams such as the Red Sox or Celtics, or from famous sons such as John F. Kennedy, or from a dramatic role in American history. When Warren made headlines, it was to be for something sinister. Originally part of the Quaybog Plantation, later called Brookfield, Warren was settled in 1727 and incorporated in 1741 as Western. In 1834, the name Western was changed to Warren, in honor of the Revolutionary War hero, General Joseph Warren. Many prosperous dairy farms were the economic backbone of the community for its first 100 years. Warren's history as a mill town began in 1815 with the first cotton yarn factory, and shortly afterward, the first woolen mill. By the 1800s, the community had switched from its agricultural base to a manufacturing economy, which it maintains today. Descendants of the original English and later Irish, French-Canadian, and Polish settlers comprise the majority of its current residents. There are only one or two black or Hispanic families living there. Major industries employ more than 1,500 people in the town. Some 57% of Warren adults are employed in manufacturing, compared to 25% of Massachusetts workers. Among the town's biggest employers are a manufacturer of commercial, military, and industrial pumps, a company that makes power presses, another that finishes and dyes cloth, and another that launders clothing and industrial linens. As is the case with many industrial towns, Warren's population is not an educated one. Of all residents 25 years old and older, 37% have an elementary school education or less. 54% have never finished high school. Slightly to the northwest of present-day Warren is the town of Ware, and a short distance from the road that leads to Ware is what old New Englanders call a town bound, a spot comparable to the place in the southwestern United States where the borders of Arizona, Colorado,